This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for January 2010. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature a few poems and talk about an article in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear poetry from Timothy Murphy.
A pinprick twinkling by a blinding candle.
And from Andrea Cohen.
If that's a bitter pill, well, swill, swallow. I'm going.
We'll also speak with Carmine Starnino about lazy bastardism.
Lazy bastardism is making poems less than what they can be in order to cater to a certain fiction of the ordinary reader.
The January issue has poems from seven different poets, including two long poems, one from V. Penelope Pelazon and one from Fanny Howe, and also a series of poems from Mary de Rockevelts.
If that last name is unfamiliar, you'll certainly have heard of Mary's father, Ezra Pound. Mary's mother was Pound's long-term mistress, Olga Ruge.
She has translated her father's work into Italian, as well as the work of poets H.D., E.E. Cummings, Denise Levertov, and several others.
She was born in 1925 and has spent almost her entire life in Italy, where she still lives, in a castle. Over the years, she's published many books of her own poetry in Italian and in English, and we have three of her poems in this month's issue. The one I'll read in a second is called Roses, and it actually has to do with a story told about her father who went down to the pub with some poets at a place called the Old Cheshire Cheese, where William Butler Yeats was going on at some length about ways of combining music and poetry, and to get some attention, Ezra Pound ate two tulips. And don't do this at home. William Empson tried it later, years later, and got sick to his stomach.
I guess it gives you an idea of what it would be like to be Ezra Pound's daughter. A little bit of an idea, right?
Yeah, the poem will give you another idea about what you can eat if you grow up in that household.
Right, yeah.
Roses, and it has an epigraph, Mangiavano la rose, which is ate the rose. Because I do not know what a hendecasyllable is, and words is all I have to transubstantiate and give, within me I hunger for a tongue of my own unpronounceable flavors, worth a thousand Madeleines, Monsieur P. As hunting horns spiral through my belly, and I say, Schmorn wisknidel, Tirstland gugelhof, Schlutza frigel prensuppe, Hodana knidel hodan o plente, Scheithofhaufen, Kioklan und Niglien, Feinkaffe, Kropfen und Tüpfnudel. So rich, so good and tasty, the speck-smoked wurst and roast chestnuts, never to be tasted again where cement has ousted the forest and the wood, gas is the flame. Because I do not know how to plant roses by the spring now dry, let my tears fill a fountain where waters no longer flow, and sing to the poet who broke the mold and ate red tulips when sitting among stiff boars. Because I do not know why lunatics hunger after roses and still appetite with petals behind high walls, and because I do not know how to chew the sound of the word in a hendecasyllable line, along the way I must plant a hedge or red roses to taste and see. That strange language I was trying to speak in the middle there is actually the Pustertal dialect that Mary spoke growing up in the Tyrol, and what that enumerates in the poem is local foods.
The Because I Do Not Know comes from T.S. Eliot, most familiarly, but also originally from Guido Cavalcanti. And The Taste and See is most familiarly from a Denise Levertov book and poem, but it originates in the Bible, actually. You can feel the way that Mary has inherited modernism. The poem is layered with different things, and it makes these shifts between the literary and the physical very quickly.
And it's bookish, too, as yeah. well, which I think is a hallmark of modernism, all the books and things that you absorb and transform.
You know, that's another thing that she inherited is a great thing from Pound. Obviously, she's a very learned poet, and mm-hmm. she moves very deftly among these different languages in her poems and among all these works of literature.
And she seems to have a fondness for her father, at the same time an awareness of how odd he was. And I think that comes across. There's kind of warmth in here, too. It's something that's a little different from a lot of modernist poems. Yeah, well, it's got a real kind of warm feel to it as right. she thinks back on.
Yeah, and it's interesting that she's quoting these modernists, Eliot and later Levertov, not quite a modernist, but...
And Monsieur P.
Proust. And Proust. And yet the point of the poem is, within me I hunger for a tongue of my own, mm-hmm. unpronounceable, flavors worth a thousand Madeleines. So it's a poem very much about wanting your own language. And how do you find that when you come out of a culture where, you know, you're the daughter of a famous poet?
Yeah.
Another poet we have in this issue is the Russian poet Vera Pavlova. She has a book that's about to be published by Knopf next month. We have 8 of her poems in this issue, and we want to read just a couple of these. They are very short. In fact, they're all 8 lines, except for the last one here. Very short, astringent poems, and they have their own very idiosyncratic idiom and music. This first one is called, Am I Lovely? Of course. Am I lovely? Of course. Breathlessly I taste the subtle compliment of a handmade caress. Chop me into tiny bits, caress and tame my soul, that godly swallow you love to no end.
I met Vera Pavlova in Holland and interviewed her, and she is a very spicy...
That's what these poems...
She can be wicked. Yeah. She can trick people. She can trick men. Very interesting poet. In the Russian language, she's considered to be quite an innovator for that reason. She kind of abandons a lot of the traditional poetics to accomplish this.
Her husband is her translator, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's something to see them work together. But the kind of sexuality and embodiment of this wild energy is something that's fascinating about her poems, even in the English translations.
So that's a sharp-edged last line. That godly swallow, you love to no end, meaning... perhaps you love eternally, but also you love to no purpose.
No purpose. At the same time, she's a very serious poet. Another poem in the issue is called Those Who Are Asleep in the Earth. Those who are asleep in the earth have an avian sense of the way. Gone, they sleep with shoes on, ready to rise and go to the pink, dispensable, barefooted insomniacs who had laced up for them the last pair of shoes.
Now that feels like an Eastern European poem that we're more familiar with, mm-hmm. like a Simic poem, or those first 2 lines are fantastic. Those who are asleep in the earth have an avian sense of the way.
Mm-hmm.
The dead become birds.
They become birds with shoes.
Right.
Yeah. But this, you know, it may be a cliche to say so, but the poems are earthy. Here, just that gesture of people having their last pair of shoes laced up for them and is part of the kind of domestic movement of all her poems.
And they're ready to rise, but of course they do not rise, and go to the pink, dispensable, barefooted insomniacs. Very poignant.
They're barefooted
yeah,
themselves.
Presumably they're insomniacs because they miss the dead. They're awake missing the dead.
I have a sense in a lot of her poems, at least the ones that I've seen so far, the nice thing about them is that people stumble around through their lives and deaths, that they are not necessarily sure-footed, but that part of the quivering excitement of it all is trying to find your way. But that's just how they strike me.
Yeah. Timothy Murphy is a hunter and farmer in the Dakotas. His most recent book is a translation of Beowulf, which he did with Alan Sullivan. And his last poetry collection is called Very Far North.
The poem we're going to hear is called Mizar and Alcor in Winter, which requires a bit of explanation for those of us who are not amateur astronomers. Mizar is the second star from the end in the Big Dipper's handle, and right next to it, a faint little pinprick of light, is its companion star, Alcor. Together, these two are sometimes called the horse and rider.
Murphy told us that in Arabic cultures, this part of the Big Dipper was traditionally a test for how good your vision was. If you could see both stars as 2 distinct points of light, then you had 20/20 vision.
Murphy also told us that last March, while he was on a long drive across South Dakota, he was listening to public radio.
To a so-called scientist who asserted that our skies are so polluted that nowhere on Earth can one any longer distinguish with the unaided eye Mizar and Alcor. Well, over my left shoulder rose the Big Dipper, and there were Mizar and Alcor.
Here's Timothy Murphy reading Mizar and Alcor in Winter.
Cirrus dispersed. As a black night grew colder, clearer, I spied the binary in the handle of the Big Dipper dangling above my shoulder, a pinprick twinkling by a blinding candle. Absent the moon, its boreal corona, I watched the stars rise east of Ellendale, Guelph and Ludden, then wheel above Verona and sleeping friends who farm near Engelvale. 1,000 miles of road. I'd shunned the pavement, which bears the burdens I no longer ferry, the cargo of material enslavement. 6 eagles hunted small game on the prairie. An Arab prince's fortunes once were measured by blooded foals, by sons his wives could dandle, by tributary quatrains to be treasured, and his eyesight, a pinprick by a candle.
The first thing that's noticeable about this poem, I think, probably, is that it's in rhyming quatrains. We don't have a lot of poems like that. Timothy Murphy always writes in traditional forms. I once heard him give a reading, and he has every single one of his poems memorized. He doesn't even carry any paper or his books or anything up to the podium with him.
He's got a very emphatic way of reading, too. Sounds a little bit like John Berryman to me.
Yeah.
Sort of assertive and knowledgeable.
What I admire about this poem very much is the way it bridges these huge distances and makes you feel the vast spaces of Arabia in hearing in the spaces of North Dakota. And he does that by bringing in the actual names of these towns, Ellendale, Guelph, and Ludden, Verona. And he links these two times, himself seeing these stars and then an Arab prince, presumably thousands of years ago.
Well, it's full of binaries, too. I mean, not to read a whole lot into it, but it's interesting about the two stars and the handle, and then so many of the rhymes have, you know, they're two-beat end words here, colder handle, shoulder candle. And even fairy prairie and dandel, which is a beautiful word. And it's striking how the two beats are so important to creating the couplets that are part of the quatrain. So he's really nicely built a whole thing out of this kind of system. It's very sort of scientific way of looking at it.
They're feminine rhyme, what are called feminine rhymes. It's interesting because an Arab prince's fortunes are measured by sons, his wives could dandel, and yet he inverts that in a way with his form.
Tributary quatrains to be treasured.
Andrea Cohen appears for the first time in Poetry Magazine. Cohen runs the Blacksmith House Reading Series in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's also the author of a book of poems called Long Division.
We have two of her poems in the January issue, and the one we're going to hear is called To Whom It May Concern.
This poem is a kind of goodbye letter to the United States, I think, and it's mostly playful. Here's Andrea Cohen reading To Whom It May Concern.
Soon I'll move to Norway. If that's a bitter pill, well, swill, swallow. I'm going, and I won't wallow, not in Norway, where they're so beyond slave labor, with laws that say a clerk must work within 5 meters of a window through which she can see a tree and by that tree be seen. My mind's made up. I will be Norwegian with Norwegian trees. I'll be seer and be seen. It's a scenic scene. It's how it goes. I'm going. Tell the top brass if they ask. I don't give a damn about their asses. But I will miss the beaches and the ashes. It's not their fault I'm leaving. They're only trees and leaving. I'm Norwegian.
This is a crazy kind of poem. Yeah. It mostly lives by its sound. It's got all these wonderful, playful sounds that hold it together all the way through. A clerk must work and see a tree and by that tree be seen.
It reminds me a little bit of Wallace Stevens if he got out more.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, that's true. I like it that, you know, maybe the laws in Norway are actually that specific. You don't just have to see a tree, but it has to be a tree that can actually see you. Also in the January issue, we have an essay by Canadian poet Carmine Starnino. The piece is called Lazy Bastardism, and Starnino takes up that nagging question, who's to blame for the fact that poetry just isn't read that much anymore?
Starnino is well known in Canada as a critic, and by some accounts, he's a tough critic with a gift for rankling readers.
About 5 years ago, he edited an anthology of Canadian poetry. It was called The New Canon, and like most of these attempts to mark off a canon, it naturally sparked debates about what got included and what wasn't.
Starnino joins us on the phone from Montreal. Hi, Carmine.
Hi.
So, Carmine, your essay is in the form of a notebook, and it's got entries on a lot of subjects. And the first entry begins, I've never had a good feeling about writing poetry. Why is that?
You know, I grew up without being read to. My parents didn't read to me. I didn't memorize any nursery rhymes. and memorize any poems. So when I first read poetry, I reacted with puzzlement. And I mean, I stayed interested out of trust that the language, you know, that language so lovely must mean something. But that puzzlement, that sense of trust, isn't something that was something I could translate back into sort of family life I had or the culture I grew up with. We're a working class, no nonsense kind of people. You know, it's a funny thing that for a long time my parents thought I was a drug dealer because, you know, I spent so much time at home. And the only kids who would spend so much time at home and earn a living were the drug dealers in my neighborhood.
No, they're not mutually exclusive, you know.
No, no. We're both peddling some kind of stimulant, I guess.
Or depressant.
Or depressant, right. Yeah. So, I mean, my sense of poetry has always been colliding with this sense that it's not sort of a real thing. It's not like a real job.
Now, you say in the piece that you're almost 40, or maybe did you say you're 40?
39,
okay. And yet you're having trouble understanding the frame of reference from poets who are younger than you. Why is that?
I just think the kinds of information, the amount of information now being compressed into poetry is far greater than it was when I was growing up. I think it's the effect of maybe the internet, social media, I don't know. But the frame of references is greater, I find. The speed at which the poems are happening, the jump cuts, the assumptions being made in the poems are essentially different, I feel.
Do you think this is a break that always happens or it's specific to our time?
Both. I think it always happens, but the speed at which it's happening is specific to our time. You know, speak to some of these younger poets. I think they feel that poetry that I write and that my generation wrote is the bandwidth for that kind of poetry isn't enough to carry the information that they want their poems to carry. I want to be careful that my reaction to these poems, which are sometimes quite queer and strange, at least to my ear, that my reaction isn't dismissal. You know, I do feel like, you know, I should make an effort to understand some of the new music, the different music that these poems are making.
So tell us, getting back to your piece for a second, what is lazy bastardism and who are you calling lazy bastards?
Well, the inside joke in the piece, of course, it's inside only to me, is that my father called me that all the time, lazy bastard. In Italian, the word is sfatigato. You know, I was the layabout that I talked about at the opening of the essay, sort of staying home, you know, reading all the time. I realize what I've done is sort of, you know, remove the sting out of that word by applying it to poets. I think about Aristotle's definition of the riddle, the essence of the riddle, he said, was to express true facts under impossible combinations. Now, I've never forgotten that, and I think that's a really lovely definition of poetry. Because in a sense, what he's saying is that the classic question of the riddle, what am I, is the question the poems ask readers. And I mean, and the solution, according to Aristotle, is an act of learning. And so it really depends on a creative response from the reader. And lazy bastardism is making poems less than what they can be in order to cater to a certain fiction of the ordinary reader who poets may believe is not up to the task of this creative response. So why lie to readers, you know? I mean, the things that excite us about poetry is that it provides things that can't be found in any other form of literary expression. And so I do feel that poets are somewhat embarrassed about this, end up, you know, writing poems that do less in the hopes of attracting more readers.
You say that along these lines, reestablishing the public's trust in poetry would be like reestablishing the public's trust in Latin. Is poetry really in that bad of shape, do you think?
I mean, I don't think we're in such a bad shape if there are readers. I don't mind that there are a few of them. I mean, I don't think poetry's value to society is expressed through the number of readers it can attract. I mean, I think it's expressed through the quality of the reading being applied to it. So I don't think poetry's in a bad shape because, you know, a book of poetry sells, you know, 300 copies or 500 copies.
Well, Sharon Olds will sell 50,000.
She does, yeah, and she's, you know, and I imagine Seamus Heaney shifts quite a few.
And Christian Book sells quite a few as well. There's a video going around on the internet of a discussion that you two had where he talks about how many books he's
does he really
sells. That's right. No, I mean, yeah. I think as poets, we're anxious for any metric that can help judge our success, and I think sales is one that we use. Certainly, the Christian has sold, you know, 40,000 copies. And, you know, and it's rising of Eunoia is a wonderful thing for him and for poetry and for his publisher. And I mean, the fact that poetry has had these localized successes hasn't been enough to change our fortunes. I think poetry is a minority interest. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, if it isn't your thing, it's hard for me to fathom how the taste might be acquired.
Well, Carmine, it's interesting that Christian Book says that poets are the laziest, stupidest people he knows. And watching that, not being a Canadian, I almost think there are points where you guys agree more than you disagree in a certain way, but that it...
I think the setup for the debate did create some tension between us, or created sort of the theater of a kind of tension. I do agree with a lot of what Christian has to say. And
there doesn't seem really to be a conflict in the idea that what he thinks would be smart and intelligent would be, you know, new discoveries, almost like scientific discoveries in poetry. And your point is kind of like, well, you can do that with what you've been given or what you inherit in the tradition of poetry, that there's nothing in that that stands in the way of these advances.
You know, there's that great line from Balanchine, there are no new steps, there are only new combinations. And I feel that the tradition sort of provides us with what we need, but you know, it can't tell us how to use it. It particularly can't tell us how to react to newness in our midst. You know, but poetry has always been interested, from Milton on, I think, or the metaphysicals in introducing science into its ambit. I mean, I think my frustration with the debate with Christian isn't with the particular ideas he has about poetry. It's about his sense that it begins with him and his friends, that he's perfectly willing to bin, you know, 500 years of poetry, of the tradition, in the sense that it just doesn't meet his needs. And I feel that that's a bit rash. And his need to sort of throw out the sonnet, for example, because he feels it's too archaic, you know. But, you know, I can't imagine why he wouldn't admire the sonnet, for example. I mean, something so unkillable. And so facing that, I'm not quite sure what the avant-garde has to offer.
Well, let me ask you one last question. You sort of go after the Griffin Prize at the end of your essay. And what do you think the chances are that Griffin Prize is $100,000 given to two English language poets, one from Canada and one from somewhere else? What do you think the chances are that you're going to win one now?
No, never. I don't think it's in the cards for me. No. But, you know, aside from some of the complaints I have about that particular prize, it has done some good. I mean, in the sense that it has sort of recognized good poets, it's provided a boost to some careers, and the media activity, just the buzz around that prize is extraordinary.
Yeah, it gets a lot of press over here.
It's some years it's been front page news.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody would have anticipated that.
Thanks so much for talking to us today,
Carmine. Oh, it was a pleasure, guys. Thanks so much for calling.
Carmine Starnino's most recent poetry collection is This Way Out, published last year by Gaspereau Press. And he has a new collection of criticism forthcoming in 2011 from Biblioasis Press.
You can read Carmine Starnino's essay, Lazy Bastardism, A Notebook, and everything else you've heard on this program in the January issue of Poetry Magazine, and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman, edited by Sarah Campbell, and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.